You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including what's next for Southern Oregon University as it faces a financial crisis, a first-of-its-kind floating solar project in Jackson County, and leadership shakeups in the Bandon School District. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
And I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And Jane, let's start with you. You did some reporting late last Friday night about Southern Oregon University and its plan for financial viability. First, give us some background on that.
So we've discussed this before, but SOU is facing a serious financial crisis, as you said. The university is currently operating with a $12.5 million deficit. That's predicted to increase to almost $17 million by fiscal year 2030. And so they recently got $15 million in emergency money from the state legislature, but they don't quite have the money in hand yet. There are some strings attached to in order to get that money, and one of those is that the university has to create a long-term plan for financial sustainability pretty quickly. The state legislature understandably wants to know that SOU will be viable long-term if they're handing over $15 million. So SOU worked with Deloitte Consulting to create a long-term plan. Deloitte made a proposal, and that included a total of about $20 million in cuts. And so SOU's Board of Trustees met last Friday night to vote on Deloitte's proposal.
So what did the Board of Trustees actually decide?
Basically, they decided that they will take Deloitte's report into consideration and use it as a resource. But now the university administration itself will have to come up with its own plan. They're calling it the SOU Vitality Plan. And so the board didn't really make any decisions about what parts of Deloitte's proposal might be used. There was some pushback about proposals to cut certain programs or faculty and staff. But the board didn't really make any decisions about what programs might be cut. There weren't really any details given on that. They didn't say what the final plan might include. So there's still a lot to be decided. There's Deloitte's proposal. They'll be considering it and then making their own plan. The board said that the university president also has to create a non-voting university transformation advisory committee, which will have students, faculty, staff, trustees, and they will be collecting, distributing information, advising leadership, communicating updates to the community. And there is sort of a looming deadline here because the board has said if the university doesn't really act decisively to create a plan, follow it through, the alternative is shutting down SOU, which would obviously have huge impacts. So it's been a pretty stressful time at the university. And then meanwhile, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission at the state approved the first step of releasing that $15 million in emergency money to SOU. So they first have to submit a request to the Legislative Emergency Board. The money would be released in two parts, one this summer, one this fall. So it's early stages, but assuming that SOU follows through with creating its vitality plan, it appears they are on track to get that emergency money.
So probably a busy time in President Rick Bailey's office.
Exactly,
right now.
Exactly.
Well, what happens next?
So the university now has about a month to make its own new vitality plan. The Board of Trustees will meet again to consider that plan on June 18th. So a lot of work for SOU President Rick Bailey and the leadership. Bailey says he's working on forming two workshop groups. One of them is focused on academic portfolio. One of them will be focused on the administrative footprint. And they will be exploring potential solutions, potential ideas, presenting alternative frameworks to be considered before President Bailey makes his final recommendation to the Board of Trustees. So they'll be holding some workshops and having to have some really difficult conversations about what might have to be cut or will have to be cut at the university. And then once that plan is formed, once the Board of Trustees, assuming, approves it, once there's a plan in place, it has to be implemented by June of 2027. So there's about a year to get all of those cuts and all of that transformation done. So there's a really quick turnaround on that. And I will just note that JPR is licensed to SOU, but we cover the university just like any other institution.
Okay, thank you, Jane. Justin, you reported on a new solar project in Jackson County. Can you tell us about this and what makes it special?
Yeah, so this is actually the first floating solar project in the whole state in Oregon, and it's on an irrigation reservoir in Central Point. Crews installed more than 1,700 solar panels onto this reservoir, so they're floating there now. And floating solar is what it sounds like. It's when solar panels are placed on bodies of water. So this reservoir where these panels were placed is owned by the Medford Irrigation District. It's called a re-regulating reservoir, which means the district fills it with surplus flows during wet months and then will release some of that water during drier periods. So the level fluctuates, but it's used just for irrigation, so not recreation or fishing or anything like that.
And what are the benefits of floating solar compared to, you know, putting solar on a building or, you know, on a solar farm?
There's a number of benefits. So first, it's going to bring in revenue to the Medford Irrigation District. They're going to sell that energy to residents and the city. 10% actually of that electricity generated will go to low-income households through the Oregon Community Solar Program. And they expect that will bring in around $75,000 per year. And that will go to their modernization efforts at the district. So Medford Irrigation District, like really irrigation districts around the state, are in this long process of updating and repairing their infrastructure. One major thing they would like to do is replace canals with piping. So moving that water through pipes, closed pipes, rather than open canals, because that will prevent evaporation, which is a problem for irrigation districts. And another benefit of floating solar is that covering the reservoir will also prevent evaporation. So blocking the sun keeps the water at a cooler temperature. I spoke with the irrigation district manager, and he says that they have issues with algae blooms in the reservoir during the summer months, and that can clog canals. Algae likes warmer waters, and so this might help there too.
Yeah, and it likes sunshine, so if the sun's getting blocked, that'll certainly help. Well, are there any downsides to floating solar?
Like other solar projects, there's a level of upkeep that needs to happen, like repairs and things like that when the panels stop working. But the district is hoping that it won't require a whole lot of this work. It's kind of, you know, set it up and then it should function on its own pretty easily. The irrigation district manager mentioned geese. They're watching.
Always
a
problem.
Right. What the geese will do. They seem to like to stand on the panels and also go to the bathroom on the panels.
Of course.
So that's one of the things they'll be looking at. But the district really will be monitoring this closely because it's kind of a test case for the rest of the state. And other districts will look at this to see if it's worth it. There was also a study that Roman had a story on a while ago, a study out of OSU last year that talked about some of the potential environmental costs for floating solar. So I mentioned the panels keep the water cool, and that can be good for some wildlife, especially some species of fish, but maybe not other wildlife, which prefers the warmer water. You know, the solar panels can also block wind from mixing with the water, so that changes the oxygen levels in the water. And the study that concluded that it really depends on the location of where you place the floating solar to depend on whether or not the environmental costs are there or not. It doesn't really seem to be a concern with this project in Central Point because it's, like I mentioned, just an irrigation reservoir. It's not really used by a lot of wildlife.
Except for those geese.
Yeah, except for the geese. And they did have to do an environmental review before starting the project.
So now that Oregon has its first floating solar project, but this technology is pretty popular elsewhere, is that right?
Yeah, it seems like the United States is kind of playing catch-up. So this is much more popular in other parts of the world, especially Asia, you know, places with a low supply of land.
And lots of sun.
Yeah, and lots of sun. That OSU study found that adding floating solar panels to every federally controlled reservoir could generate enough power for 100 million homes. So that, you know, obviously won't happen, but it shows what could happen, the potential energy there. Other floating solar projects are being considered by irrigation districts in Oregon right now, and all these districts are really desperate for revenue to fund these modernization efforts that I mentioned. And so this could be a good option. So they're going to see how this works in Central Point, and then that might inform decisions in other irrigation districts.
Okay, well, thank you, Justin. Jane, you had a story this week about leadership shakeups in the Bandon School District. That's something that you've been covering for a while, some turmoil there. What happened?
So briefly, this week, the superintendent at the Bandon School District gave her 60 days notice, and two school board members also resigned. They accepted those resignations at their meeting this week. So the superintendent, Shauna Schmier, had been with the district for 5 years, and she says she's been presented with other opportunities. She wouldn't say what exactly that opportunity is or where it is. And then Brianna Hutchins and Angela Cardis were board members. Cardis was the board chair, and they both resigned as well. They both blamed the teachers union and community members for what they called negativity, hostility, and toxicity in the district. And those were some of the reasons that they ended up deciding to resign.
Yeah, you mentioned negativity, hostility. There has been a lot of turmoil there. Mm-hmm. Can you give us some background on that?
It's been a really pretty turbulent year for the Bandon School District. There's been teacher departures. There's been complaints against district leadership. There's an ongoing third-party investigation into some of those complaints. There's been a lot of tension between the administrators and the teachers union and some community members. There have been other school board members that have resigned earlier this year. The superintendent says that she has faced slander and abuse. The school board also accepted the resignations of 9 other employees at Monday's meeting.
Wow, so that's a lot of turnover.
It's a lot of turnover. So there, unfortunately, you know, it seems to be pretty contentious. There's kind of two sides. Brianna Hutchins, who's the school board member who resigned, also spoke during public comment saying that the teachers union is vindictive and dishonest. The teachers union says they're focused on accountability and transparency. And then meanwhile, there's also this sort of parent community group, which is called Bandon Schools Deserve Better. They say that they're trying to create positive change in the district. Some of the resignation letters mentioned a small group that is creating a hostile and unsustainable work environment. That's a quote. So they didn't mention this group by name, but it likely is this group. They keep pointing to this sort of group of community members, group of agitators that they say are causing problems. Of course, the group itself, Bandon Schools Deserve Better, says they're just trying to you know, focus on accountability and transparency. So there's pushback from both sides. It's kind of a rough situation. There's a lot of turmoil, disagreement. There's mistrust. Everyone does seem to say that they want to move forward and focus on the kids and keep focusing and moving forward, but there is still a lot to deal with here and still a lot of mistrust that seems that it'll have to be worked through.
A lot of hirings to make.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, what are the next steps for the district?
Well, hirings, for one, the two open school board seats need to be filled. They will need to hire a new superintendent. So the superintendent's last day, Shauna's last day, is in early July. So a school board member, Troy Russell, is going to work with the Oregon School Boards Association to hire an interim superintendent. No real details were given on that at the meeting. Then there's also those ongoing complaints that I mentioned against the school board and the superintendent and leadership. The board has dismissed some of them, sometimes without really publicly stating a reason. And then meanwhile, there's a third-party investigator who is currently investigating some other complaints. And so the board is expecting a full report on that investigation by the end of this current school year. So we'll watch out for that. And we're also waiting, the district is waiting for a decision in an unfair labor practices complaint that was filed by the teachers union. There was a hearing with the State Employment Relations Board that ended back in February, and so also waiting for a result on that as well.
Okay, thanks, Jane.
And Maria, you took a break from editing and had a wildfire story. So fire season is starting earlier than usual this year. What specific conditions are making officials especially concerned about Southern Oregon heading into the summer?
Basically, it's some ongoing drought. It's been dry. The vegetation is dry. And the other big thing is it's a really low snowpack, really minimal snowpack in everywhere, almost none. And, you know, it's conditions where it might not be that bad right now, but it could deteriorate really rapidly with a few hot days.
Yeah, it was a very sad ski season.
Yeah.
So the fire danger level is beginning at low, but why do officials say that could change quickly?
Well, first of all, low doesn't mean no risk. There's still some risk when it's low. But, you know, wind events or some hot days like we had earlier this week can really dry things out, change it, and elevate, you know, fire behavior. And human-caused fires always remain a big concern. So, you know, things like sparks that come off machines or, you know, escaped campfires or what have you, those can get out of control really quickly.
What areas are covered by this?
Well, it's 1.8 million acres in Jackson and Josephine counties, and its areas protected by the Oregon Department of Forestry's Southwest Oregon District. And that really includes a lot of land, state, private, and some federal forest lands as well.
And then really quick, now that it's fire season, what activities are restricted?
Debris burns, equipment use in dry grass, fireworks, exploding targets, and campfires are allowed, but you need to make sure to have a fire extinguisher or other ways to extinguish it.
Great. Thanks, Maria.
Thanks, Justin. And that's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions of things we should cover through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or on your favorite podcast platform.